All right, welcome back, everyone. This is Cases from the Community, Integrating New Research Findings into Clinical Practice, a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with the American Oncology Network. We are moved on to module number 6 in our day's agenda. So we saved the best for last, and Dr. Liu is gracious and kind enough to be here with us. We're going to address colorectal and gastroesophageal cancers and new data that's impacting practice. Dr. Liu is a professor of medicine, director for clinical research at the University of Colorado Cancer Center, director of GI Medical Oncology. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
Absolutely.
Past the disclosures and diving right in. Again, this is a snapshot of data from the AON network of patients. You know, 1,900 plus colorectal patients, 180 or so gastric. Pretty fair sequencing, but obviously some room for improvement with respect to disease states that have a fair amount of actionable mutations.
Wow.
Quite a bit of Signatera. So obviously some uptake in the community when we think through ctDNA testing and its predictive and prognostic value. Curious about that microsatellite. Is some of that hidden in the pathology reports? As far as therapeutics, you have TAS-102 with or without Bev, and then fraquinib, pretty decent uptake on Fruzaqla there. So HER2 positive colorectal patients and those receiving TDXD, so some uptake early on, both in the colorectal and gastric space. So we do like to start with a case just to provide some clinical context for the data that we're going to review. Then we'll ping you with a few questions that we can address, and then you can elucidate those answers or delineate the answers a little better as we go through the data. So first case by Dr. Lamar and Dr. Beauchet.
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar with a follow-up question from Dr. Beauchet.
60-year-old. Gentleman who was diagnosed with a stage 3 colon cancer. He was treated with 6 months of FOLFOX. And 2 years after chemotherapy completion, I did imaging and he had a lesion in his liver. I talked to the hepatologist and he went and he was able to have resection. So we talked about chemotherapy after resection. He opted not to do chemotherapy and wanted to be monitored. I sent a Signatera test on him and it was negative. And we have been following him with Signatera. After about a year of following him on Signatera, he had repeat scans and he had hilar lymphadenopathy that I had not seen before. And so I did a PET scan. The area was FDG avid. And so I did a Signatera and it was negative. So I sent him to the pulmonologist. He had a bronchoscopy and actually the adenopathy was sarcoid.
Wow.
And so he was started on steroids. I've repeated a Signatera and he remains negative.
Incredible. What a case.
Yeah.
I think probably the most common question that should be asked is, should you use ctDNA to decide on therapy for patients with stage 2 colorectal cancer? Are there patients with stage 3 disease today who are ctDNA negative that shouldn't get chemotherapy? Should they get a short course versus a long course, 3 versus 6 months? And how often should we be following ctDNA? And then in a patient with metastatic disease, is ctDNA a tool that we can use to monitor response?
So just to add to Dr. Lamar's case, a similar case, but it was the opposite outcome, had a negative ctDNA, but a positive liver biopsy within 2 weeks for metastatic colon. So these aren't perfect, but that's why we do the trials. So questions for you. A patient who underwent resection of a solitary hepatic metastasis 2 years out from adjuvant FOLFOX for stage 3 disease, what role does ctDNA play there and in general?
Yeah, so
First of all, thank you guys for hanging in there late in the day to talk about colorectal cancer. You guys have had a lot of information, a lot of great talks, so thank you for ending your day with us. And so, right, ctDNA is an incredibly important and emerging topic, and for all diseases, right, but certainly in colorectal cancer where there is a ton of additional data. For this particular patient, this is a very, very, I would say, not uncommon situation where somebody has already had that adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX, and then you're kind of left with this recurrence that happens a period of time, sometimes a long period of time after adjuvant therapy is completed. And you have to wonder, okay, well, does this truly represent 2 years after, you know, initial resection and completion of adjuvant therapy, you have a new liver lesion. So are we going to re-challenge with FOLFOX? Did FOLFOX technically kind of fail in the situation because there was a recurrence? And I think that this is a situation where I would utilize ctDNA, right? Because there are two things. Number one, we know in oligometastatic disease, resection for colorectal cancer, adjuvant chemotherapy has not been proven to improve overall survival. There's evidence that chemotherapy in the setting improves relapse-free survival, but very, very little data to suggest that improves overall survival. So why utilize a test where we don't have randomized data? Well, I think in this situation, it may at least help guide the patient in terms of saying, okay, well, there's very, very little data. I do not want chemotherapy if the ctDNA is negative. If the ctDNA is positive, it may lead you to believe that there's some more micrometastatic disease around, and you might choose an option like FOLFIRI or even a rechallenge of FOLFOX. Is there any data to tell you that that is absolutely what you should do? The answer is no, and I think that that data will be coming. But right now, I think we're basing this off of kind of common sense logic and just saying, hey, if disease is present, at least at a molecular level, maybe we should really try and consider chemotherapy.
What are your thoughts on using ctDNA to make clinical decisions about continuing or withholding in stage 2 and or stage 3? I know we got some slides coming up.
Yeah, so I'll definitely address this in the slides. I would say right now it's easier to utilize ctDNA to make escalation decisions as opposed to de-escalation decisions, right? We have huge data sets, right? In stage 3 colon cancer and the use of FOLFOX chemotherapy in that setting. It's hard to start withholding chemotherapy that has an overall survival benefit based off of observational data. I'm going to show you a ton of observational data, all right? But what we need is randomized data. So it's hard to start de-escalating chemotherapy saying, your ctDNA is negative, I'm not going to give you chemotherapy. We don't have that randomized data. But what about an escalation decision, right? And so if you have a patient with low risk stage 2 colon cancer, where you traditionally do not give chemotherapy, can you utilize ctDNA to use chemotherapy in that situation if the ctDNA is positive? And I would say right now, you know, again, not that there's randomized data to tell you this, but the answer right now might be yes.
Last two questions as far as how often should we be monitoring ctDNA, and then can we look at tumor fraction, allele frequency to predict response? Is that a leap, a bridge too far?
Yeah, and I don't think anybody really knows how frequently we should be getting these tests, right? We don't want these tests to incur great expense to our patients, but simultaneously, we like to have the data, particularly if a test becomes from positive to negative or negative to positive. When you look at a lot of the observational studies, it's about every 3 months that we obtain ctDNA. In terms of monitoring for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, you can utilize this test to monitor, right? These tests oftentimes will give you a quantitative amount of ctDNA fraction that's in the blood that you can measure, but you kind of get that similar information with CEA, and you're getting a CT scan every 2 to 3 months anyway. And so where this may be helpful is, and there's data on this, is in the use of immunotherapy, right, where it can better predict the response to immunotherapy than maybe some other biomarkers that we use. But right now, although you can use it, many people do not use it for monitoring metastatic disease.
All right. Thanks for those insights. We'll dive into the data here.
Yeah. So lots of data to show you, which is always very exciting. And I'm going to really divide it up into stage 2 and stage 3 disease. This is the Dynamic study, which is an Australian study led by Jeannie T's group, really looking at essentially two things: ctDNA-guided management of stage 2, and this includes low-risk and high-risk stage 2 disease versus standard management. And we quiz our fellows on this all the time. What are the high-risk features for stage 2 colon cancer? We talk about T4 disease, lymphovascular invasion, you know, lack of lymph nodes that are removed, those types of things. Or what if we use ctDNA to either escalate chemotherapy in ctDNA positive patients or de-escalate in ctDNA negative with observation. And when you look at the recurrence-free survival curves, you can't find Kaplan-Meier curves that are on more on top of each other than this, right? Which really tells two stories. Number one, no difference in outcomes between ctDNA-guided management versus our standard, we use clinicopathologic features to guide our use for adjuvant therapy. The second take-home message is that a lot of these patients did great, right? Anytime we have recurrence-free survival that's higher than 90%, that's cause for celebration. The key here is what I'm showing you in the upper right-hand corner, and that is that the ctDNA-guided group had half the use of chemotherapy compared to standard management. What does this mean? You achieved the same clinical outcome by using less chemotherapy. And I think that that is one significant take-home point. So I would say, and you'll see these kind of scattered around in my talk, ctDNA can be considered in low-risk stage 2 colon cancer. And basically the point kind of being, if the ctDNA were positive, who would not offer that patient chemotherapy? Now, do we know in this setting that chemotherapy saves lives? We don't know that. But there's some compelling data I'm going to show you in the stage 3 setting. So what about stage 3? We know that the problem with stage 3 colon cancer is that it's a one-size-fits-all treatment. We're giving everybody FOLFOX, right? But the problem is half of those patients are cured with surgery alone, and another 20 to 25% are going to have recurrence whether you give them chemotherapy or not. So essentially, out of 10 patients that have stage 3 colon cancer, you're treating 7 to 8 needlessly, right? Either because they're going to recur or because they're cured. And so the question is, can ctDNA really improve our ability to determine what patients should receive chemotherapy and what patients should not receive chemotherapy? There are two major observational studies. One is the GALAXY study done by the Japanese group. This is the United States study, the BESPOKE study, where essentially they just took patients with stage 1 through 4 colorectal cancer prior to surgery and then after surgery and just followed them with a tumor-informed ctDNA assay. And the results are what you would expect. If ctDNA was positive postoperatively 2 to 12 weeks after surgery, they had a very, very high recurrence risk or recurrence rate. If you were ctDNA negative in this window, you were essentially recurrence-free. Survival was extraordinarily high. What's interesting is the ctDNA kinetics. And that is, if you can clear your ctDNA and sustain that clearance, look at that recurrence-free survival. Now, the caveat here is that it's very, very small numbers, but this also reflects a Japanese study where there are essentially no recurrences in that patient population. What if you transiently clear your ctDNA? You're just shifting that Kaplan-Meier curve. You're still going to have a high rate of recurrence, and usually you develop molecular recurrence by the 15th month after you clear your ctDNA in patients that only transiently clear the ctDNA. This is a very, very cool graph. And what I'm showing you here is the benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy in these patients. If you're ctDNA negative, that's the right curve, you received no improvement in disease-free survival with adjuvant chemotherapy or no adjuvant chemotherapy. But interestingly, all the benefit in terms of disease-free survival was truly in that MRD positive population. And so these are really my take-home points. For stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer, ctDNA is without question the most prognostic test, but we still don't know how predictive it is. And so for stage 3 colon cancer, I would say the ongoing studies are critically needed to determine whether we can use this information to withhold chemotherapy from a patient with stage 3 colon cancer. This is a shameless plug. This is the Circulate North America study being led by Dr. Dasari at MD Anderson, and I'm co-leading the study. And it's essentially our North American study to say if you're ctDNA negative, you can be randomized to chemotherapy or surveillance with ctDNA. This is the de-escalation question. What if your ctDNA is positive? Can you get benefit from escalation of chemotherapy to FOLFIRINOX compared to CAPOX or FOLFOX? And if you're being surveilled in the observation group, you can switch over to the ctDNA arm. All right.
Really phenomenal question. So I want to hit the pause button for 1 second and ask you this, not to get into the weeds of this, but kudos for colorectal for being the pioneer here, right? I mean, why has this not happened in other disease states? And so is it something particular about post-translational modification, you know, methylation here that allows this test to be done in this disease state versus others? And is there, we don't want to get into vendor-specific testing, but, you know, is does the individual test matter so much, or just is it a binary equation?
Yeah, you know, and we, you know, we can certainly get into this depending on the questions, but the tumor-informed assay assays appear to have higher sensitivity, but you longer turnaround time. And those of you in the audience who have ordered tumor-informed tests know it can take a significant amount of time sometimes to get the test information back. And what if you see the patient 6 weeks after surgery, which is not uncommon in a medical oncology practice, then that makes that turnaround time very, very important. Part of the reason why we designed Circulate the way we did was to allow a dose of chemotherapy before you get randomized, because you might not get the test results back. If you do a tumor uninformed assay, you can get those results back in a week. So that time is much better, but we know that the sensitivity decreases a little bit. We also know that the tumor shedding and the detection in colorectal cancer is higher than in many other diseases, which makes this, colorectal cancer, the ideal disease to study this in. But of course, it's not always applicable to other diseases as well.
Fantastic answer. All right, Dr. Mulheron is going to share another case with us.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulheron, a 49-year-old Hispanic man who presented with de novo metastatic colon cancer.
He'd never had a previous colonoscopy, so he'd had symptoms for at least 6 months, and then he had a sigmoid mass, moderate divergent adenocarcinoma, mismatch repair proficient, and NGS didn't show anything but HER2 positive. So it's HER2 positive expression. He's KRAS, NRAS, BRAF wild type. So he's the exact person that, based on 80405, FIRE3, and others, this is the one you would think you'd want to do a frontline EGFR inhibitor for. But what about the HER2? He received FOLFOX and panitumumab as frontline treatment, and he's had a good response to therapy. He's about 9 months out now. So we have tucatinib, trastuzumab that's approved. What do you think about that? Was there a case where if they're HER2 positive where you would consider starting with something like tucatinib, trastuzumab, or TDXT? Let's say they're really frail and they don't have ILD, although TDXT certainly has its own sets of toxicities. So what's the best option in those cases? And I think also to put a plug in, there's a lot of patients who don't get KRAS, NRAS, BRAF, HER2, MMR tested initially. And so there's a lot of room for just improved testing to identify these patients, find out we can treat them.
In keeping with true fashion, Dr. Mulheron, he gets his questions in. So I think it shows the thought process there in patient care. So when you think through the sequencing of these HER2 therapies, you know, does it matter 2+, 3+? What are your thoughts, A, on the level of IHC staining based on the data and the timing of incorporating those regimens given alternative options in the space?
So we've heard about trastuzumab deruxtecan in several sessions now, right? So this seems to be a theme of, you know, HER2 being a very, very active target, particularly metastatic colorectal cancer. Much like what has been said previously with Dr. Lee, when we think about the data in GI, it is truly in the IHC 3+, right? The other way studies have defined this is IHC 2+, but the ISH or FISH is positive, right? And that would be kind of considered to be somewhat equal in terms of the way these studies have kind of grouped patients. And so IHC 2+-ish positive, yes, I would consider that to be HER2 positive. But unlike the data in breast cancer and maybe some other cancers, there really is a very, very low level of activity of trastuzumab, deruxtecan, and other agents unless it's truly IHC 3+.
Approach to management and detection of ILD in this space, I think we've sort of addressed that throughout the day quite a bit. So
yeah, just out of curiosity, just as a show of hands, who has had ILD from trastuzumab deruxtecan from giving it? Okay, so there are a handful. And I'm sure you've heard this kind of consistently over the course of the day. Grade one is really just radiographic, right? Radiographically seen, but the patient is asymptomatic. That is the only time you might be able to re-challenge your trastuzumab deruxtecan. But the moment anybody has any symptoms that's grade two or higher, you're going to immediately stop. You're going to start steroids. And you're not going to re-challenge that patient with trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Great guidance. Thanks for the clarity. And then, you know, we get into the TAS-102 in combination with Bev. What are your thoughts? We've got some new agents in this space. You have regorafenib that's been with us for a bit. We now have fruquintinib in the space. How do we sequence these appropriately? And is that thought process evolved over time?
I think what you saw from the survey results was that many people within AON are choosing TAS-102 and bevacizumab. And then there's some use, right, of fruquintinib. We know, and I'm going to show you the sunlight data with TAS-102 and bevacizumab. With fruquintinib, that was done technically in the fourth line setting, was the FRESCO-2 study. But when you choose these agents, really, you're going to take a look at the patient, right? I think because there's been so much experience with TAS-102 just in our country, just in general, that it was very easy to add in bevacizumab, and it seems like that seems to be the practice pattern across the United States. Having said that, if you have a patient that's dealing with a ton of cytopenias, sometimes giving patients a chemotherapy break may be helpful, and so you can use an agent like fruquintinib. I think the use of regorafenib has really gone down over the past couple of years, and so really it may be a little bit more patient-dependent, but the practice pattern suggests that more providers have experience with TAS-102 and bevacizumab.
And just as an aside, we have seen some payer mandates really yep. dictate that.
Right. To Dr. Mulhern's point about biomarker testing in colorectal cancer, and this is going to come up in gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancer, the idea of biomarker testing is obviously extraordinarily important. This looks nothing like the lung cancer, right? Graphs.
It's close. You're getting there.
We're kind of chipping away at it, like 1-2% at a time. But you see, you know, many of the biomarkers that we're now actively looking for colorectal cancer, but focusing specifically on HER2. If there's one thing that I really want to drive home is that there are some very clear clinical and molecular features of HER2 and metastatic colorectal cancer. And that is that there's a much higher incidence in the left colon. When you look at the studies that are done, 80 to 90% of the patients had left-sided tumors. So this is really enriched on the left side of the colon. It's not mutually exclusive with RAS and RAF mutations. So you can have HER2 amps with a KRAS mutation associated with slightly more aggressive disease, right? Associated with lung and brain metastases. There's no evidence to suggest that HER2 impacts response to chemotherapy. But what you heard in Dr. Mulhern's case presentation is that there may be a hint of resistance to anti-EGFR therapy. There's a meta-analysis done by Dr. Saab at Mayo Clinic showing that patients with HER2 amplifications respond less or worse to anti-EGFR therapy. There's some other studies suggesting that that is not the case. So I'm going to say that there's a possible resistance mechanism to anti-EGFR therapy. There's one regimen here, tucatinib and trastuzumab, and I'm going to show you trastuzumab deruxtecan data. Here's the Mountaineer study. This is in a heavily pretreated patient population that had an overall response rate of almost 40% with an overall survival of 24.1 months. As it is, in small subsets, even in a common disease like colorectal cancer, you know, this is a single-arm phase 2 study, but these are pretty outstanding results. Tucatinib trastuzumab has accelerated approval for our patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. What about trastuzumab deruxtecan? Again, cohort A, in this heavily pretreated refractory population with HER2 expressing tumors, cohort A is the one where I'm going to show you the majority of the data. This is in that HER2 positive IHC 3+ or 2+ ISH positive patient population, with the primary endpoint being overall response rate. Now, again, what you're seeing here is a pretty phenomenal progression-free survival and overall survival. The caveat here is that several of these patients had prior anti-HER2 therapy, around 30%. So unlike trastuzumab tucatinib, there is data in pre-treated patients with anti-HER2 therapy with trastuzumab deruxtecan. There's a dose-finding study that was done in a phase 2 setting, 5.4 mg per kg versus 6.4 mg per kg. 5.4 mg per kg every 3 weeks is the recommended dose. This is the FDA accelerated approval that's tumor agnostic. Many of you, of course, are aware of this. This happened in the spring. But, of course, the recommended dose was 5.4 mg per kg. Moving on to the refractory space where there is not a biomarker-directed therapy available, TAS-102 versus TAS-102 and bevacizumab was done in the Sunlight study looking at overall survival. And what you see here is a significant improvement in overall survival with the addition of bevacizumab, 10.8 months versus 7.5 months. I would say here the response rates are still quite low, right? 8% in the TAS-102 and bevacizumab arm. When you look at the safety, the good news, as you all well know, is that adding bevacizumab to TAS-102 is a fairly easy thing to do. You see a slightly higher rate of hypertension, but overall the toxicity seems very similar between the two regimens. And so for refractory metastatic colorectal cancer, the take-home points really are, of course, biomarker testing, right? We have to test for HER2. And really, you're kind of focusing more on the RAS-RAF wild-type population, okay? There is some data with trastuzumab deruxtecan having activity in patients that have concurrent KRAS mutations, okay? How I do it, and I'm going to go through a patient case very briefly because we kind of went through this, but I start with trastuzumab and tucatinib because, again, there's data for previously treated with anti-HER2 therapy in the trial that included trastuzumab deruxtecan. So I go from trastuzumab to catinib, and then I use trastuzumab deruxtecan. Dr. Maharian also asked about, well, would you start with in a frontline setting with anti-HER2 therapy? And the answer by the NCCN guidelines is you can actually consider that in patients who are not eligible to receive standard chemotherapy. I would say TAS-102 and bevacizumab and fruquintinib are now FDA-approved options in the refractory metastatic colorectal cancer setting. I would say that while these agents should be used, they improve overall survival. There's no question about that. The response rates leave a lot to be desired. And I think that that's why, you know, we start to think about clinical trials in this setting as well.
So before you jump into your case, which I'm intrigued about, but thanks for providing actually great clarity on your thought process there in the HER2 space. So let's say that was a stage four patient that came in. You would start with FOLFOX plus a biologic in that case.
Yeah, and so I am a slightly more compelled than others about the resistance of HER2-amplified tumors to anti-EGFR therapy. So I typically start with FOLFOX bevacizumab. It does mean that I may have the option of using anti-EGFR therapy in the future. In the second-line setting, though, I do move straight into the anti-HER2 space. Why? Because I want to be able to offer my patients targeted therapy earlier. It allows me to have FOLFIRI to be used as a refractory regimen if they progress on anti-HER2 therapy. But I always like adding in targeted therapy earlier in a patient's treatment regimen or treatment plan as opposed to doing it on the back end.
Great, great way to manage the patient journey and keep as many bullets in the holster.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
All right, let's get into your case.
Yeah, and I can go through this pretty quickly because it represents also the case that I think that you guys already heard about. But this was one of my patients, and I know you guys are seeing a lot of younger patients in clinic. This was a 51-year-old that was diagnosed with locally advanced rectal cancer, underwent total neoadjuvant therapy, which is a conversation for another time, but underwent low anterior resection and then had ostomy reversal at week 6. Unfortunately, the initial restaging studies started to show some of these really, really small lung nodules, which you guys see in clinic and are very, very frustrating because you can't always biopsy them. Molecular testing did show that the patient was triple wild type, but HER2 amplification was detected by FISH. The patient was microsatellite stable. Again, frontline treatment in a patient that already received FOLFOX. We started with FOLFIRI and bevacizumab every 2 weeks. Unfortunately, restaging studies at 2 months revealed progression in the lungs, and then this treatment option that you would select here. I think, in all honesty, you could try an anti-EGFR therapy. You could also try trastuzumab deruxtecan. In this case, because I wanted to be able to use trastuzumab deruxtecan in the third line setting, I started with trastuzumab to catinib, and the patient's doing quite well.
Great. Thank you.
Any other colorectal cancer questions before we move up in the GI tract here?
All right. Yep. Let's head north.
Okay. So I won't spend too much time on this study. I just want to give you a quick update in terms of, what is new in early stage disease for upper GI cancers. I do want to show you data from the Matterhorn study. Okay. So you've heard a lot, right, about immunotherapy and the addition of immunotherapy, and certainly happy to answer questions about immunotherapy in a metastatic setting. But, the question always is, well, can we move some of these therapies that are now approved in a metastatic setting for upper GI cancers and move them into the perioperative space? So we can also talk about the perioperative therapy for gastric and GEJ cancers, because that's also an area that's under tremendous flux. But FLOT, combination chemotherapy, is really considered to be one of the, big standard of care therapies that we use in the perioperative setting. We give FLOT. Preoperatively, patients undergo surgery, and then they get postoperative FLOT, and we know that the outcomes have improved with that regimen. So this is in locally advanced gastric and GEJ adenocarcinomas. Patients are randomized 1-to-1 to receive placebo plus FLOT or durvalumab plus FLOT. They receive surgery, and in the treatment arm, they continue that durvalumab with FLOT, and then they receive 10 doses of durvalumab as monotherapy in a postoperative setting. And the primary objective here is event-free survival, and really all the data I have to show you on Matterhorn is simply this, that the pathologic complete response rate was higher in the durvalumab plus FLOT arm at 19% versus 7% in the FLOT alone arm. So does this mean that there's going to be a tremendous difference in event-free survival, disease-free survival, or overall survival? We don't have any of that data, but I'm going to say that this data will be coming. And so this is kind of like a just be prepared to kind of see more about this as we move on to the GI ASCO and ASCO. I didn't show you data from the NEO-NAPIGA study, which looked at nivolumab and ipilimumab for deficient mismatch repair or MSI-high gastric cancers. I will tell you that at our institution for MSI-high gastric cancers in the preoperative space, right, for locally advanced disease, we are using immunotherapy. And the reason why is because the complete response rate with immunotherapy in the, you know, small phase 2 study was roughly 60%. That is an unbelievably high pathologic complete response rate. So we do utilize immunotherapy for MSI high tumors, you know, when you do find them. All right.
All right. Next case presentation from Dr. Patel.
The next case is presented by Dr. Patel, a 65-year-old man with GE junction adenocarcinoma.
Initially diagnosed so-called localized, and he has a stomach swallowing trouble, so they went to put the PEG tube in for the nutrition. And when the surgeon go in, he's seeing a lot of retroperitoneal mets, which he biopsy and say, well, you don't need chemo radiation. So we find out his IHC 2 plus fish came back positive. We also ran the liquid biopsy, came back ERBB2 positive. And as you know, pembrolizumab has indication. So we chose, since because he was HER2 positive, we chose with the pembrolizumab based chemotherapy. He had a great response, but now having a neuropathy, so I dropped oxaliplatin.
Anything you'd like to hear them discuss in terms of how to manage him if and when he has disease progression?
I went back and looked at it. He's positive for Claudin 18. So we have a new treatment that's got approved. So we all wanted to hear about it.
I agree. Yeah.
So before we dive too much, all right, GE junction, assuming it really is more on the esophageal side and they're a radiation candidate, what is your take? I mean, are you platinum, taxane, XRT followed by IO, or where does FLOT? You know, and it's a bit of a judgment call given tumor location, it may perhaps, but.
That's right. And so, for those of you who saw the presentation at ASCO, the ESOPEC trial tried to answer this question, FLOT versus CROSS, right? The problem is that the field continued to move forward while that trial was running. Now, FLOT was found to be superior to CROSS, but this was chemo radiation with carbotaxol followed by surgery. But what do we do now in patients that receive the CROSS regimen? We give them adjuvant nivolumab, irregardless of what their CPS or PD-L1 score is. And so the problem is that the comparator was no longer considered to be the standard of care. Having said that, the data are compelling enough from ESOPEC that at our institution, we are utilizing FLOT in this setting. Now, do we know that FLOT is better than CROSS plus nivolumab? We don't know that answer. But I think that the gastric data in combination with, you know, what we see in the ESOPEC does suggest that, you know, utilization of FLOT in the perioperative space does make a lot of sense. In patients that are either not candidates for FLOT, which is a sizable percentage of our population, right? I think CROSS followed by surgery followed by adjuvant nivolumab is a very, very reasonable strategy. And certainly we employ that in patients that we don't think can tolerate FLOT.
And FLOT at this point is without IO.
That's correct. That is correct. Yeah. And then again, right, as you saw from the Matterhorn data, there are two things, right? We know that durvalumab appears to improve pathologic complete response, but that data is also immature. The FDA is now going to ask these companies to prove the value of the components of therapy. What does that mean? Is it the neoadjuvant immunotherapy? Is it the adjuvant immunotherapy? So this becomes a very, very tricky question because they're not just going to be able to say, well, just give it and give it for a really long time. They're really going to ask companies to say, is it truly the neoadjuvant that helps patients, the adjuvant that helps patients, or, you know, in some cases, neither. So
great point. All right, so we talked about Claudin 18. There's a recent FDA approval for zolbetuximab.
Yep.
This is a drug that's can be difficult to give on the first cycle, right? And so what are your thoughts about how we integrate zolbetuximab into the treatment algorithm?
Is anybody already reflexively testing for claudin 18? Show of hands.
Yeah, okay. I think it's on a lot of the NGS panels automatically.
They do. Now. Yeah. And so we can get this from third-party companies. You know, in-house at the University of Colorado, we are now reflexively doing it, which may give us a little bit of a quicker answer. So, you know, there, and I'm happy to talk about CPS scores if you guys want to talk about like nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and, you know, where the FDA and the NCCN really are going to, I think, come down, and I think they already have, is that if your CPS score is one or greater, then they're going to allow, right, the use of immunotherapy. And there are a lot of trials trying to break down, is it 1 to 5? Is it 5 to 10? Is it greater than 10? I think the easy thing to remember is if your CPS score is greater than 1, you can use immunotherapy. But, you know, and I'm going to show you a slide on now how complex the decision making now is for patients with metastatic gastric or gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma. But, you know, what is the information that you have to get? And in relatively fast fashion, right? Because in the case that you just heard about, patient can't swallow. You need a response and you need it fairly quickly. So you know, you got to get HER2, you got to get claudin now, you have to get CPS scores, right? And so I think a lot of times what we're going to practically do is start with FOLFOX chemotherapy, and then as we get this information, then we can start adding in these targeted therapies. Are we going to add in nivolumab or pembrolizumab? Are we going to add in pembrolizumab, trastuzumab, because this patient, I think, also had HER2 amplification? And then is the patient claudin positive? I'm going to show you data from the SPOTLIGHT and the GLOW studies. One of the things that you had mentioned is that it can be hard to give this therapy, you know, up front. And so what we know with zolbetuximab is particularly in the first two cycles, you can have significant nausea and it can be fast. It can be within the first, you know, 1 or 2 hours after you give the drug. So please understand that nausea vomiting is one of the major side effects that they saw in the phase 3 studies. How do you deal with that? You can actually slow the infusion down. Now, the problem with zolbetuximab is that it takes 2 hours already to infuse. And so you're really lengthening, right, the time somebody's in the chair, which can be kind of painful. But if they're really having a lot of bad nausea vomiting, certainly start, you know, think about adding in fosaprepitant. You're obviously also doing ondansetron. You can do steroids, but you can also slow down the infusion, and that appears to improve the nausea and vomiting as well. Also understand that it is worse in the first 1 or 2 cycles, and then it does get better after that. So you kind of have to, you may have to cheerlead some and get your patients through it, but they will improve over time.
Use olanzapine in the order sets with
you
that?
You can, absolutely, yep.
All right. Go through the numbers.
Okay, well, let's see what the data says. So zolbetuximab is an interesting drug, right? And we don't, unlike maybe other targets that you have heard over the course of the day, you know, this is one of the few, you know, diseases where claudin 18.2 seems to have made a difference in overall survival. So it is a tight junction protein. It's normally expressed in gastric mucosa cells. But in cancer, it can be exposed on the surface of these cells, making it a potential target. So zolbetuximab is an IgG1 monoclonal antibody that targets claudin 18.2 and induces some ADCC. So there were several phase 2 studies. It's amazing how, you know, we used to use epirubicin in this disease a lot. But now, obviously, I'm going to show you some studies with CAPOX and FOLFOX. We don't use EOX, but the phase 2 studies had shown some promising activity. And there are two studies, one utilizing CAPOX, one utilizing FOLFOX. It's nice that we have both global phase 3 trials reported that show similar results, but it's very, very simple calculation. And that is in patients that are claudin positive, identified by having greater than or equal to 75% of the tumor cells with moderate to strong claudin 18 staining, they're randomized to receive CAPOX chemotherapy or CAPOX in combination with zolbetuximab. And when you look at the progression-free survival, and what I'm showing you here is the overall survival curves, the 12-month overall survival rate, 58% versus 51%, 24-month overall survival rate, 29% versus 17%. I will also make the point that in these studies, when you look at overall response rate, they're not significantly different between the two, okay? And so what you're really getting and you're buying is progression-free survival and overall survival, not this dramatic increase in response. The SPOTLIGHT study was essentially the same study just done with FOLFOX, and what you see is essentially similar results. The median overall survival improvement, 18.2 months versus 15.6 months. And again, this is the reason why, I mean, literally 1 to 2 weeks ago, it was approved for gastric cancer in patients that are claudin positive.
And then on the positivity, right? So help us out. You know, if the bulk of the people that are positive, right, are really positive.
Yes.
So you're not dealing with a lot of, you know, 40, 30%ers, right? You either are or you're
not. Yeah, I think, you know, CPS scoring can be extraordinarily difficult in this disease. And I think that there's been plenty written about the discrepancy in CPS scores, even if you just change pathologists, right? For claudin, this is going to be a much easier assay, I think, for pathologists to determine positivity versus negativity because it's either all there or it's not. Yep, great point. And then, you know, just to keep in with the theme of continuously talking about trastuzumab deruxtecan, certainly the gastric 01 study showed this incredible response rate in HER2-positive gastric cancer in the refractory setting, right? So, you know, for our patients with HER2-positive, newly diagnosed metastatic gastric cancer, we're going to do, in patients that are eligible, FOLFOX with pembrolizumab with trastuzumab. That was the KEYNOTE-811 study. Following that, if you have progression on that regimen, we know that we can move on to trastuzumab deruxtecan, and I do like to use this in the second line setting. And again, you're just seeing the difference in response rates and also overall survival and progression-free survival of trastuzumab deruxtecan versus physician's choice chemotherapy. So this is a really nice slide from Sunny Kim. These are therapy options in advanced gastric and esophageal cancers. And it's just, I think this is kind of nice because this is now the world that we live in, right? In terms of frontline therapy, if patients are HER2 positive, again, you're going to start with, you know, chemotherapy plus trastuzumab and pembrolizumab. You're going to, in patients that are CPS positive, you're going to add in immunotherapy alone. If patients are claudin positive, you're going to add in zolbetuximab. And then you have now some second line and third line regimens available. This is a rapidly evolving field. And it's really amazing how this field has changed, not only in the metastatic setting, but also the perioperative setting. And now, you know, one of the questions that I think comes up now that you have a chart like this, right, which used to be much simpler about 5 years ago. Well, what if somebody is CPS positive and claudin positive? You know, what are you going to start with? Luckily, when you look at the patients that are CPS 5 or higher and they're claudin positive, that only represents probably about 13% of our patient population. So it's going to be rare that somebody has super high CPS positivity and are claudin positive. But the question is, well, what are you going to start with? And the answer is, we don't know. We know that there are there are additional trials going on combining zolbetuximab with immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy. But until that happens, we're going to be flying a little bit blind. What I would tell you is that if you have a very, very symptomatic patient where you need response, then I would probably err more towards utilization of immunotherapy, adding that into chemotherapy. If the patient is relatively asymptomatic, then I think it would be fine, honestly, in that situation to just start with claudin therapy, knowing that you can always go back to immunotherapy if needed.
And again, that's referencing your point earlier that the zolbetuximab doesn't buy you a higher response rate, but more progression-free survival prolongation, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, good point. I think, you know, you took the wind out of my sails. I was going to ask you that very question. Like, so what do we do with the you know, we're conditioned to give IO with everything, right?
Right.
I mean, it's the French fries of medical oncology. And so, you know, it goes with anything. So I think that would be the natural default behavior. But, you know, the zolbetuximab is only indicated in the frontline setting, right?
Right.
And so, you know, we don't want to miss the opportunity, which sort of, again, highlights some of the themes from today, which is appropriate testing, you know, and again, the value of ADCs in this space.
I think one of the things that we're going to run into a problem, and again, I'm hoping that it's not going to be a ton of our patients that run into this problem of needing both zolbetuximab and immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy. But when you look at the SPOTLIGHT and the GLOW studies, they're using CAPOX and FOLFOX. So what else are we supposed to combine zolbetuximab with if we give it in a second line setting? So in other words, is zolbetuximab going to be effective in combination with paclitaxel and ramucirumab, which is a very standard second line regimen? We don't have that data. And so it's going to put a lot of our practitioners into a conundrum for this, again, small subset of patients, of what to do in the second line setting if you start with zolbetuximab or if you start with immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy. So it's just kind of food for thought. Again, I think some additional studies are going to help answer this question. Obviously, it makes it a lot easier if, just like HER2, you just combine it all together. We just don't have that data right now.
And just a question regarding point of care. Do you isolate those zolbetuximab patients for their first infusion, understanding, you know, the risk of nausea
within
based
1 hour.
On mechanism? Yeah, I mean, you know, and they're doubled over in pain. I mean,
you have to be ready for it.
You don't want to be in the chair next to them going, hey, you're not giving me what you gave them, are you?
It's a very, very good practical point. And exactly, I mean, again, this happens very, very quickly and it is one of the more common things that we saw with the drug.
Okay, moving on to Dr. Warsh's case.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh.
This is an 82-year-old man with a significant smoking history, presented with dysphagia, ultimately underwent imaging endoscopy, which revealed a mass rising from the esophagus, squamous cell carcinoma. Staging PET revealed mediastinal adenopathy. This patient was 82, a heavy smoker, had some lung disease. The esophagectomy would have been a little challenging in general. So we started with upfront chemoradiation to sort of control the disease. We did the standard chemoradiation with weekly carboplatin paclitaxel. We did a scan after as well as an EGD, which both showed some evidence of residual disease. He wasn't a good surgical candidate, but given the fact that he did have residual disease, we really didn't feel comfortable just observing. And then after discussion of sort of the pros and cons of the different options, we decided to pursue 1 year of adjuvant nivolumab, which data shows basically if someone has residual disease after definitive treatment, then they benefit for nivolumab for 1 year. I guess the questions I have for this patient is, when someone has residual disease after chemoradiation, has it been your standard of practice to do the 1 year of adjuvant immunotherapy? If we were to send the PD-L1, would a PD-L1 expression inform your decision-making in this sort of case?
So fantastic questions, right? I mean, and we see this all day, every day in practice, right? You know, you have this agreement, we're going to do this and we're going to go to surgery. And then they like pull the ripcord on surgery and they're like, yeah, I'm not doing that. And you're forced to make these decisions. So love to hear your thoughts about squamous cell carcinomas resectable or not, that are status post-definitive chemoradiation. What's the role of an adjuvant IO in that place? And does PD-L1 impact your decision process?
Yeah. And, you know, again, like you said, this is a very, very common situation. And these patients are typically have kind of tenuous performance statuses, right? And so particularly if they look a little bit more beat up after getting neoadjuvant therapy and neoadjuvant radiotherapy, it is understandable. Some of these patients are just never going to move on to surgery. You know, the clean cut boards type question, you know, that you would kind of follow through the NCCN pathway is simply, right, neoadjuvant chemoradiation followed by surgery. And if there's any residual disease remaining, those are the patients that should receive a year of adjuvant nivolumab. And that study, right, has been done and completed. And we know that that's standard of practice. But what if patients don't go to surgery, right? And so this is where the NCCN guidelines don't help you, because there's no data, right, in this situation. I think, right, there are two things. We know that it may take time for radiation to have its full effect. So again, the hope is that maybe you will have at some point at least a complete clinical response. But regardless, given that in this particular setting, that there is the potential for, you know, residual disease, I think it is very reasonable to use adjuvant nivolumab in that setting because, again, of the persistence of disease. Is there data that I can tell you and put up here to show you that that's 100% what you should do? No, that simply isn't. But, you know, you imagine that if there is residual disease, you want to offer that patient the best available chance to remain disease-free for as long as possible. And I think adjuvant nivolumab probably offers you that ability. Now, so I would recommend adjuvant nivolumab in this case, but I think that people could debate that, and I think that would be a very, very reasonable thing to consider not doing it just because there's no evidence to do it. The second part is a very, very interesting thing, right? When it comes to CPS score and the utilization of adjuvant nivolumab, wasn't really tested in the adjuvant setting. Now, you can rest assured that you're only talking about 10% of the patient population with advanced squamous cell esophageal cancer that are CPS zero. It's a very, very small number. So here, CPS scoring would likely not impact my decision to use adjuvant nivolumab, mainly because in the post-surgical setting, we don't use it either. And again, you're looking at a small population that's truly negative or zero. So in that situation, I do not use CPS scoring.
Great. Appreciate the clarity. Maybe that's the case where you use real-world evidence data, right, and see what the practice patterns are and follow that prospectively.
Absolutely.
To see if there's value. I don't know that the trial would ever be done.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It was an absolute pleasure to have you here today. We learned a lot.
Thank you very much.